You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and I'm on holiday, so I'll make this quick. Today, I'm bringing you this episode with Jamali Maddox. This is an absolute killer of an episode and he's a killer of a comedian. Really, really big jokes. And we're going to get into a lot of detail on how he finds writing the top line, the first line of a premise, almost easier than writing the punchline to it. So he starts, I'll let him explain better than I can, but there's lots and lots of technique stuff in here. And if you'd like to jump into the extras, you can find some, we'll go pretty deep on the production of Hate Thy Neighbor, which saw him, it's a show he did on Vice, which saw him write 16 hours of comedy each in 3 days. We'll also talk about extracting laughter from horrific things and finding the fertile ground between outrage and consensus. All of that available to members of the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. But now, pulling back into the wide angle, here's Jamali Maddox.
We last saw each other in Montreal.
Yes.
And that little, the TV, the bit where you run the set for TV.
Yeah, and sure. I bombed out.
Yeah, well, man, it was good.
You're a nice guy.
No, I'm not a nice guy. Being the comic, I'll tell you what the difference is. That room, is it the attic? I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah.
There's the downstairs bit where there's people going, oh, some kind of comedy festival.
Yeah.
And then there's the upstairs bit where the comics are waiting. Yeah, you were killing it with us.
Because we
didn't have the kind of culture shock you know what I mean? It was like,
do you know what was weird about that whole Montreal experience was I realized the whole act changed with a line, because it's only recently because whenever I'd done a show overseas, I always knew that they wasn't British in, like, so when I do a show in, like, I was doing Europe mostly. So I was doing, like, say, you know, the Holland and the Belgians and all of that shit, the Lithuanias, the Finlands. And there was always a thing in the back of my mind of, like, okay, these people aren't from where I'm from, so culturally they're different, so I have to address things differently. Where it's only when I started going to North America, because they're English-speaking people by their first language, in the back of my mind, I forgot how culturally different they are. And my whole shows, because I was dying every show, and the whole show changed with me addressing the fact that I have this accent and look like this.
Because previously you hadn't been doing that.
I wasn't doing that.
Because you didn't feel like you were on foreign territory.
No, and I kind of assumed they knew more about England than they do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, they know fucking nothing. Because the thing is, as well, is we take for granted, because we're British, like, I say to American comedians, I go, the thing about doing comedy in America, because when American comedians come over to England, if I know them, they'll say, oh, what stuff don't they get? And I go, you'd be surprised how, like, if you say Walmart in Alabama, we get the reference. With, if I say something, if I say, you know, fucking, if I say
Super Drug and Kettering.
Yeah, Super Drug and Kettering, or even, like, if I say, you know, Brixton.
Sure.
You know, even just that reference, because Brixton here can be a punchline.
Of course.
You know, I live in Brixton, so you know what that's like. Yeah, and everyone goes, oh, we know what you mean when you say, but they don't get it. So it's like, my whole show changed. And I remember, like, I'd done the British show. So I'd done the first show and I got away with it, but it took 5 minutes to warm up.
Yeah.
And then the whole show changed where I go, I'm British. I know I'm not the guy on the brochure.
Yeah, right.
And then the set changed from there.
Okay.
And it's wild how just one line of me addressing something that in my mind is normal. Because I exist as me. I don't exist as a, you know, I don't exist looking at me. I just exist as me.
Sure.
Do you know what I'm saying? So I don't, you know, I forget what people see.
Yes, okay, I see what you mean. Yeah. Like in that, okay, you're looking out through your eyes. So
yeah.
But that's interesting because you as a performer, you are a very strong flavour.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I don't know. I get what you're saying, but for me, I don't.
Because you just exist as you.
I just do it.
Sure.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, because I think that was the change in comedy for me, is I thought, like, it's when I stopped thinking so much about what I'm saying and just say it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a turning point for me.
I look back at your set from the Chortle Awards,
which you won in
2014.
I was 2014, long time ago.
And I mean, and no time at all.
Yeah,
like that's,
I know,
you know,
weird, yeah.
That's from winning a thing to your position now. That's pretty. It's pretty good going, right?
Yeah.
I remember seeing that set at the time. Uh-huh. I didn't see the awards, but I remember seeing the gig at the time. I think we did like an Amused Moose gig together.
We did.
Thing
and that fucking gig that cost £10 for a Red Bull.
Yeah.
In the hotel.
Yes.
And it cost like £10 for a Coke and some shit. Yeah, I remember that gig. Yeah. I remember that gig, man. That cost bare money for a drink there, isn't it? Yeah, I remember that.
I remember, like, see, it's interesting because you just said that, like, what you do now is that you don't think about thinking about it. You just go out and say it. I remember at the time seeming like that was, I'm sure that's part of why you won that competition was because you looked like you were just going up there saying this stuff.
Yeah.
You look like one of those duck to water people who kind of went, oh, I can do this, and just started doing it.
No, I bombed a lot, man. Like, coming up, bro, I was, like, bombing, man. Like, you know, I had bad sets, man. Like, I would die, man.
What kind of clubs? Where were you working?
Oh,
what sort
man,
of
like, I was...
Were?
Oh, not mainstream shit. I was doing, like, open mics. Started at the Lions Den, and then I was doing the Jesters and all of that. So I came from the class of, say, it was, like, me, Tim Renkow was around.
Yeah.
Ed Hedges.
Yeah.
Who else was about? Archie, my dogs.
Uh-huh.
Bunch of people. Gabriel. Gabriel was about one of my good friends.
Gabriel, what's his surname?
Gabriel Bulu.
Bulu. Okay, yeah, I've met him.
He's been around for a minute. But anyway, so boom, good friend of mine, funny dude. And so fucking, I was and I would bomb a lot. Like I would bomb a lot. It was sometimes it would go good and sometimes it would go bad. I had a problem recreating things was my big issue. Like a lot of the stuff was. I didn't realize some stuff's just funny in the moment. And I was trying to duplicate these things that you can't, sometimes you can't reduplicate things. Do you know what I'm saying? And it's like, so some things you can, obviously you have bits and setups. And I'm not saying that I riff, you know what I'm saying? I don't do like what Russ Hitz can do. I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I love if I could, but I can't. You know what I'm saying? I can't do like what Phil K does and where it's just all riffing. Like, obviously, I have set up bits and that. But it was when that moment I realized what exists in the moment and what doesn't.
Was there a specific moment that made you realize that? Or was that just like a thing you learned along the way?
Oh, progressively. Yeah. Progressively. But I don't know, man. Like, I mean, again, is you know, there was a time, I think I was, you know, there was a time where I was a shit open micer.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying, though? Like,
I don't
think I had that thing of like, I came in and I was just fully developed with who's this dude? Damn,
he's a guy I've
been going for years. Like, I don't think I had that.
But I think what I'm getting at is that
I'm very critical about myself. Even now, I think I'm shit. So, do you know what I'm saying, though? I have that. Like, you know, you asked me for a video.
Yeah.
I was putting that off because I hate doing it. I didn't want you to see it. I was embarrassed.
And you sent me one that was dated, new stuff 2019, and you said, oh, it's old as shit. And I was like, clearly within a year.
Yeah. I was embarrassed, man.
Yeah, okay.
I just have that thing about me. Like, I just, you know, I'm very self-critical about my stuff. Like, you know.
That is interesting. We'll get to that.
Yeah,
we'll
other comedians do an impression of me as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Elliot still does an impression of me where it's just like, yo, man, I just died. I know I got like 4 applause breaks, but I just died. Isn't it? Like, that's the impression of me. And it's between me and Marlon Davis.
But there is a bit of Marlon in there.
But that's their impression of me. It's just like me with my eyes closed with my head up.
Yeah.
It's a pretty funny impression. But yeah, so
you know you've made it when people could do an impression of you.
Yeah,
I think. Well, that's what I mean by a strong flavour, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
you can do an impression of you.
Okay, yeah.
I'm not going to do an impression
of
you.
No, of course. Yeah.
But because you've got like, when you say like with your eyes back like this,
uh-huh.
with your head back and your eyes kind of closed, you're kind of thoughtful, you have a sort of preaching element to
uh-huh.
you. I remember from that, like the very beginning of that set, and I remember it from seeing it years ago, The very first thing you say before you any do, what was the first thing you said before you actually started in on the material?
Yeah.
You said some sentence that ended with son. You know, you were like, shit, you just walked on and went, shit's about to get real, son.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, bits like that were like, I'm really interested in that because that to me belies a certain, either maybe it's confidence, maybe it's lack of confidence and you feeling like you have to posture in a kind of way. Yeah. But it seemed to me like that's not a bit, that's not a punchline, that's not written. But nonetheless, the flavour of that, of you walking in the room, is just like, this is different to the last 10 things you've just seen tonight. Do you know what I mean? Is that deliberate?
No, like, do you know that me saying that, and I only notice I say it all the time. It was it sort of just became like I get quite ritualistic about things.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? Though, mm-hmm. and it kind of came just a ritual of mine, where I just say it and I say it before. Sometimes I whisper it, but I just say it to myself. You know what I'm saying?
That's like, beautiful. I'm so glad we picked up
It's like I'm embarrassed about. But I do it. It's just, I don't know. I think it's like, it might be to hype myself up, but it's like kind of just a ritual of mine. Like I kind of, you know, I have like quite a formatted way of what I like to do before a set.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I kind of find it hard, especially if I'm dating a girl with that, like I don't want to talk to anyone right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to, you know, I kind of like to be in my own mind. I like to be around comics a lot because it's sort of, you know, I like to be around that energy of like the green room or, you know, at the back of the room. Like I like that energy. And then like I like to smoke about 10 cigarettes. I like to sip on a beer. And then, you know, I like to just catch just the end of the guy who I'm about to go on after, the MC or the last comedian. And then I like to go. And it's sort of like, for me, it's all a preparation of what I'm about to do. Do you know what I'm saying? It's quite a ritual and it's quite a, and if that does fuck up in any way, there is a part of me in the back of my head like, nah, this shit's going to go bad now. Do you know what I'm saying?
Is there any evidence to support that?
No, it's fucking bullshit. It's just all mental shit. It's mental illness is what it is. There's been times I've been late and I've had to rush on stage and I've had a fine set. But it's just what I like to do, and that's what I like to say. So yeah, I have done that for a long time. But
and it establishes a sort of an authority over the audience, and a kind of there's a status thing in
there as well.
But it also, the way you're saying it is, it's kind of in inverted commas. It's not like Def Jam, where you come out and be, shit's about to get ready, you know.
But you sort of
pronounce it in inverted commas, which gives us. It's quite an. I don't mean it's an important, like you'd struggle without it, but it is quite an interesting way to sort of set out your story.
Yeah, yeah. I don't, again, it's that weird thing I don't like. Say, you see, like doing things like status or, you know, are you playing the low or the high and all of that? That's all stuff that I learned later with craft.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just did what I did on stage. So it's like, I never had that thought of like, okay, I got to sit the president, I'm on stage, I'm running the show. Like, I never had that. Do you know what I'm saying, though? And I don't, it's only recently that, it's only when other people tell me, oh, you're high status on stage. Like, I didn't know. It's not like sometimes other comics will tell me what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, oh, yeah, I do kind of, like, because I'm just doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense, though? Like, I don't, like, I've never really been
that
guy.
I don't think anyone sits down and thinks, how shall I approach this? I mean, I do.
No, some do. Like, there's some dudes where it's like, their shit is mad, like, you know, just craft, like, you know what I'm saying? And they really think of all the little, like words and, okay, if I say this word and that word, like me, I just try to feel it out. You know what I'm saying? And I don't think it's a good thing either. I just think it's how I do it.
I think it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Because what it speaks to me of is a sort of an instinctive comic ability. And I guess that's what I'm referring to when I say that you seem fully formed as a comic.
Not that
immediately all your material was going to be your strongest stuff.
But you had the bones there.
You had the bones of it because your relationship to us, it feels like your voice on stage is the same as the voice with which you talk to me. It's the same with the same way you text me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's... you have a very strong sense of self.
Yeah.
Are you amongst your friends from outside of comedy or your childhood friends? Is that the same? Are you the same you? Do you speak with the same voice to them?
Yeah. Do you know the thing my uncle said one time to me? I got this uncle. He's a musician dude. And he's like a Rasta dude. And he's always in clouds of weed smoke. And he's got dreads to the floor. And his singer name's Ghetto Priest. And he said something one time that I think rings true sometimes, is he goes, sometimes angel, sometimes devil, but always you. So it's like, you take on many facets. Uh-huh. So it's like, you know, and I try to still have an element of myself. So if I'm with my brethren from where I grew up with, I'm a little different to how I'm with you, just naturally.
Sure.
But there is still a running through line of yourself that I think rings true. Like there's a version, like the version I am on stage is just a heightened version of what I am. Like on stage, I'm a little bit more brass. I'm a little bit more, you know, even sometimes taking on qualities that I would like to be in my real life more. Just okay. I'm saying, though, like,
yeah, yeah.
So like, you know, I'll be more flirtatious with women, or I'll talk a lot more shit, and I'll be a lot more bold. And if I don't like, because in my real life, if I don't like something you say, I might let it slide. Because, you know, fuck it, I don't want to hassle. You know what I'm saying? That's mm-hmm. what but if I'm on stage, I ain't letting it go. Do you know what I'm saying, though? And I have that sort of element to it, too. But that's still a part of me, and still a part of, because there must be a part of me that is argumentative, and there is a part of me that is, you know, is confident and is these things. But then, you know, in the real world, I think it's dulled a little bit just because you have to live life. Do you know what I'm saying? Where on stage, it's just it's a freedom to it, where you can just sort of live these much more eccentric parts of yourself. Because it's sort of, there is a mentality of what this thing is. And what this thing is just a performance. It's just an extract. We're not in reality right now. We're just in a, you know what I'm saying? No, we're just in a space of ridiculousness.
Are there any
Does that
moments?
Make any sense?
Yeah,
I feel like this makes no sense.
No, absolutely. It makes absolutely sense. Which is
I don't
why
the listeners be like, what the fuck is this guy saying, man?
I'm bouncing on to the next related topic rather than going, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah, cool. I feel like you would call me out on my bullshit. You'd be like, Jamali, what the fuck are you saying, man?
Nah. Are there any moments, or have there been, over those, so if you did the Chortle Award in 2014, did you start like the year before or a couple of years before? I don't know what.
I did my first show at like maybe 17, 16. And then I started taking it seriously at 90. Because what happened with that tool, I'm sorry if this is a long ass story, but that's what happened with that tool. So I was about 20. I went uni the first time and I got kicked out. And I was a bum growing up. Like I was just a bum kid. Like I wasn't, you know, I wasn't doing nothing positive with my life. I just lived on my mom's sofa. I was a bum. And I remember my mom said to me, you got to sort your life out. You either go get a job or you go uni or you do something. And I didn't want to get no fucking job. So I'm like, fuck that, I'll go uni again. So I went uni in Manchester. And I had just started to do comedy a little bit again, like taking it more seriously. And I wasn't getting booked in London. And I heard about all this work in Manchester. It was sort of like this Zion, this, you know what I'm saying, this promised land of work. So I went up Manchester and I couldn't get booked out there either. And I remember like I just started getting gigs back in London. Like Comedy Calf started hooking me up.
Okay.
No Fortnight. He was giving me too many gigs because he just had this sort of like, you know, belief in me for whatever reason. And so I would come back every weekend and break even from Manchester, trying to fucking hustle gigs, like just, uh-huh. you know, running around doing weekends and that.
Having moved to Manchester. To get some work.
Yeah, but I'm going back to London. So I was wrecking out from that. And it was weird because I'd done this course called Acting with Comedy Practice. And it was just an acting course, but it had some comedy element to it. And the reason I picked it...
In Manchester. What were you studying? Is that part of your...
Yeah, Acting Comedy Practice.
Gotcha. That was
a course.
That was the uni? The
uni was Salford.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, the uni was Salford.
And the name of the...
Course.
The course. The whole degree, you got a degree in
no,
it?
No, what no, kind no, of I dropped out.
Oh, right, okay.
It's a BA.
That's what I mean. That course, which you dropped out of, was a degree in acting with comedy practice.
Yes. Understood. Yeah, cool, cool.
My apologies.
Cool.
That's all right, disaster.
Man. I know white people like to clarify degrees. Other people would have just heard that and been like, yo, cool with it.
But you straight to race there. Lazy.
You know what I mean, man? I had to bring some. I don't want people to be disappointed. Jamali's on, they ain't talking about race yet. But so I was there and I was like, I was miserable too, man. I hated it. And I remember like, we had a comedy bit and there was third years who had done comedy. And they had doing this stand-up course bit. And I think Kiri taught it as well.
Okay.
But I never made it to that year. And what happened was is they had Jason Manford come down to watch the kids, watch the third years do stand-up. And then he had some extra time. He was like, any of the first years do stand-up and want me to watch it? So I said, yeah, cool, I did it. So I did like 4 minutes in the lecture room. And he just looked at me and he just said to me, yo, just quit uni. Like, you're a comedian, fuck this shit. Like, this ain't for you. Just go do. See, stop messing around. Just go do comedy. Stop playing around. You're being silly. He goes, like, slow down a bit. That's all. Like, there's nothing I can tell you.
And how meaningful was that to you at the time?
Yeah, man.
Was that like a ray of light? Like, holy shit, I can do it?
Because the thing is, I already had that thing of in my mind, I was done. You know what I'm saying? I was done with uni. Like, I knew I weren't built for it. Like, it's just not me. Like, the same way with jobs. Like, I just can't. Like, I couldn't. I can't adjust to it. I can't get into the mentality of it. I can't have someone tell me, okay, you need to put this box there. But I know that box is quicker if I put it there. But yeah, the rules say. My brain just can't compute with that. So I knew I was done with uni. I didn't know what I was going to do because I didn't think comedy was going to happen. And so he said that to me and he was just like, yo, just quit. I actually saw him about 2 years later and he recognized me. He was like, oh, so you finally quit then. Thank God for that. He goes, you need
a lot of confidence on the part of Manford.
Yeah. No, Manford said to quit uni. He just said, just go, just be a comic. That's what he said to me. Just go be a comic. Stop. And you're saying to me, like, stop playing around. What are you doing here? Stop being stupid. And then what happened was is I entered the tutorial and I had got ill. I ended up in hospital because I had a tattoo that got infected. I got cellulitis. I was technically still enrolled, but I didn't have to go in because I was mad sick. So the day I came out of hospital, I did my heat.
Okay.
And I remember people were like, yo, you're mad laid back. Your style's laid back. But it was just because I was on drugs, right? I was just pepped up on painkillers. So I passed, I won the heat. Then I came to London and I won the heat, and I got to the finals. And I said to myself, I said, okay, cool. I'm going to work hard at comedy now for this 6 months until Edinburgh. And if I do well in the tutorial, I'll do comedy. But if I don't, I'm just going to quit. Like, I'm going to quit comedy and get a normal job or something. And I ended up winning the tutorial. And then I dropped out.
So you end up getting to the tutorial final.
Yeah.
You win.
I win, yeah.
Did that feel meaningful to you at the time? Was that like, this is it, it's going to work?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, what happened was, it was funny because there's a story, you know, who was working? Was it Corey Shaw?
Yeah.
So Corey Shaw, who was working at Chul at the time. Like, I didn't think I was going to win. Like, I just didn't have that in my mind. Like, so I remember I was laying down at the back and Corey was like, okay, everyone's got to get up now. Everyone stand up. They're about to release the winner. I just turned around. I went back to sleep. Like, I'm just laying down. And she was like, okay. And she knew I had won. She's like, Jumali, do you want to stand up? I'm like, nah, I'm good, man. I'm going to lay down. I'm going to sit this one out. And then they said my name. I was like, damn, man. I remember, like, you know, I won $2,000. And I was like, man, that was some good money, dude. That was, like, probably the biggest check I got legitimately. You know what I'm saying? And it was just like, yo, that's wild. Like, And it was a good feeling, man. I remember, like, I had, like, then I had met the guy who is now my agent, too. I'd met him that night, and he was like, hey, you looking for agency? Hey, come, you know, let's have a meeting tomorrow. And, you know what I'm saying?
So this is Jumali. Really good fun talking to him. He's so vigorous, you know. He really gets what he's doing. And he has an enormous amount of innate ability coupled with a kind of political sensibility. And as I said in the extras, we're going to get into a little bit about extracting laughter from difficult or horrific things. Lots more stuff to come up with Jumali in just a second. And you can follow him at Jumali Maddix, M-A-D-D-I-X, you know, like it says on the show notes of this episode, at Jumali Maddix on Twitter, and go to jumalimaddix.com to find out about his tour. He's been on Frankie Boyle's New World Order recently, and he's got a new show coming up on Vice called Brexit Stage Left. Perhaps more about that in just a moment. So I am on tour myself, as you know, comedianscomedian.com/tour for all of your tour dates, the ones that I'm really pushing because this is selling really nicely. I would love you to come along if you're in Glasgow and Newcastle, but the ones that I'm really pushing are in York and Leeds. They were a late addition. They've had much less lead-in time. I've really enjoyed playing in both those places in the past. So if you are in York or Leeds, or if you know comedy fans in York or Leeds who might be interested in seeing me, or if you've got family there, or if you've met anyone from there, or if you've got an enormous marketing budget you'd like to push their way, that would be fun. I'm very pleased to say that the final show of the tour is coming up in Cambridge, at Cambridge Junction on the 28th of February, and that one is really shifting. So I hope you will get along there and see me move up from the little room to the big room, which I'm absurdly proud of because I have never not had a good gig in Cambridge. So that's all the tour stuff you need to know. Let's get back to the rest of this episode with Jumali Maddix now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you're on stage at the Chortle Award doing that thing, and did you feel like it was the right choice of the winner?
Oh, do I think I deserve to win?
Yeah.
In hindsight, I think I had a good set.
Okay.
I had a good set that night.
Were you kind of a ringer because you'd been gigging loads by that time?
Or Red Richardson was in it. Red Redmond was in it. Okay. And Red Redmond was going longer than me back then still. So mm-hmm. like, it was like, you know, it's like I met the requirements to be in it.
Sure.
You know. But there was like a couple of, but there was like, you know, not anything on my mind because I thought he's funny too. But there was a couple of people who they didn't want to really be comedians.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
They were a student and they were doing it for a laugh.
One guy who was like, I just want to be famous. You know what I'm saying? Like, I remember talking to him about it and he goes, he's wanting to be famous. But yeah, you know, a couple of people didn't want to be comics. So it's like, you know, like I think I had a solid set, like looking back on it, you know, I took like, you know, some risk with some of the bits.
Go on.
You know, like, I mean, cause I could have done a lot more of a straightforward set. I remember I had this closer. I didn't know what to, I think I just wrote it. It was this joke I had about, I had this roommate who was Chinese, and it's a true story, and her name was Ting Ting.
Yeah.
And I remember sort of the awkwardness of having a name that I perceive as racist, but it's more racist because I don't want to call her actual name because it made me feel racist. And then about how she had, she ate my eggs. And I was like, does she eat my eggs because she comes from a communist government, so she thinks it's everyone's eggs? And I had this whole routine about it.
Yeah. I mean, I've watched that routine. I've reminded myself of that routine this morning.
It's a
great routine.
It's a good routine. I'm happy with it, man.
It's a winning routine. Because the thing about the routine is it's domestic and it's personal. Yeah. And it's also big picture, wider issues. And I think that's emblematic of a lot of your stuff.
Yeah.
Which is that you dig out from something, not necessarily inconsequential, but from something kind of mundane or real or, you know, like day-to-day life. And proper, you're really skilled at pulling back and going, bang, this is about the economy.
Yeah,
the stuff
you
do on the Apollo about the vagina economy.
Oh, the pussonomics.
The stock market.
Yeah, the pussonomics. Kind of
That is a... And I saw the Apollo clip. I feel like I've seen a much bigger version of that.
Yeah, I've done like... Because like, that's an edited version.
Yeah.
It's mad funny because when I was doing the Apollo, I remember Anthony, the guy who books it, because they give you basically you tell them your set and they go, look, can you not say fuck, can you not say this? And I remember saying like, yo, can I have four pussies? He goes, you can have four pussies, but you gotta give me one shit back. I go, okay, I'll give you a shit back if I can have one fuck. I'll give you that one fuck, just no cunts, Jamali. I can't spare him. And he, like, blessing that he did let me do that routine, you know, which was a, you know, quite a out there routine about how the price of pussy fluctuates with a girl giving it out too much. And yeah, so he, you know, like, you know, it's like, but even then, like, it's only someone pointed that out to me that, oh, your thing is that you take small things and make them big. Where I didn't, I just, it's just how I wrote. Do you know what I'm saying?
So, yeah, so, but given that you had done a bit of training in how to write comedy, who was influencing you? What were the ways in which you were thinking, like, even if you weren't planning, I'm going to do this? What comics were you seeking to walk in the footsteps of?
Oh,
what,
man,
what was
I
your
loved,
basic
like,
idea of what's
I love, like, I loved American comedy. Like, there was something about, because the thing is, it's like, so being young, watching comedy, I used to watch Paramount comedy. That's when Paramount was on, so I used to watch Tom Stade and all them dudes, and Mike Gunn was on it, Paul Chowdhury, like all them, I grew up watching that shit too. But it was always the real, like, but they weren't like mad famous, but it was just like they were doing shoot sets on like Live at the Comedy Store. Mm-hmm. And it's like the famous comedians were sort of old white dudes. And even though I got the funny, I didn't relate to it.
Yeah.
But where I related to American comedians more, because they sort of talked about my experience more, especially black comedians. So like, you know, the Dave Chappelle's, the Chris Rock's and all them guys, like, and Patrice O'Neill's, like I understood it more, like it resonated. And it was that sort of thing of talking about being an outsider, you know, because I'm not really too good at, and I learned this recently, I'm not good at doing that whole comedy of like, hey, you know what we do?
Mm-hmm.
I can't really write like that. I kind of write like, hey, this is what I do, looking out. You know what I'm saying? I can't mm-hmm. be like, you know that thing we are?
Mm-hmm.
I can't write like that. You know what I'm saying? But I kind of, that's like, you know, that's the comedy I kind of appreciate with that sort of American, especially American black comedy. And the sort of like, especially Patrice O'Neill, I think he's like the best that ever did it. Like just that honesty and having that, you know.
The elephant in the room is just extraordinary.
Mate, it's like the one, that HBO half an hour, he does a Showtime half an hour special. And he's got a routine that was so risky. It was about like how, it's about how, you know, you think I'm misogynistic. I'm going to give you a chance. If your pussy broke, how would you keep your man? Everyone says like, suck dick, take anal. And he goes, see, I gave you a chance and you just told me that you're nothing but a series of holes, right? And what I love about that routine is that he gave it out. And that's risky to give it out like that and be like, oh, you tell me. Because one of them could have said something. You know what I'm saying, though? Like one of them could have said, you know, have a conversation, but they didn't.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? He put it out to them and they still, you know what I'm saying? And that's risky. And I kind of respect that riskiness and kind of that, you know, that out there-ness. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Because, I mean, it obviously makes sense.
And the honesty.
And
the sort of the forefront to know that that's what they were going to say. And also, he's one of them comedians I love because I don't agree with everything he says. Like, I think that routine is deeply some harsh shit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still fun. You know what I'm saying? No? Mm-hmm. Like, and I like that he's so funny that I can disagree with him and still make me laugh.
Your stuff, you've got some big, big jokes. Like, mm-hmm. but, you know, I don't just mean, like, they hit hard, which they do. But you've got some kind of almost like the fact that, you know, the egg thing or the pussynomics, you know. Pulling back to that big picture and ending up with like a punchline that you go, oh, that I can see that working on a big stage because it's got that kind of Chappelle or Burr kind of quality of going like, whoa, there it is. Yeah. So when you're writing those, do you know when you've got one? Are there downsides to doing routines that big that like your next routine is like, oh, this is like kind of small?
Yeah,
joke.
That's why I've had like hard time writing hours sometimes, especially I don't think my Edinburgh shows have been on point. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
I feel like I haven't hit my Edinburgh show. Like, I always find the show on tour better than I do in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
I've always, like, you know, I feel like I haven't had that good, that solid Edinburgh show yet.
Okay.
Because I do kind of have those big set pieces and then some other shit. And, like, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of hard to follow that.
Fucking good
sometimes.
For you for saying so, because not everyone would admit that. Do you know what I mean? Because I think, like, if I think of your brand,
mm-hmm.
and I hate using that word, but that's what I'm talking
it's
about.
It's weird that word keeps on coming up more and more. I never used to hear that word. And well, I'm not saying you. I'm just saying in general.
Sure.
Like, it's weird how that word seems to come up a lot more now.
Everyone's thinking about marketing because it's so difficult. The industry's contracting.
Yeah, and it's changed now where I think you kind of have to be a private contractor now, where you kind of have to be a business, self-business, you have to promote.
Yeah, and in wider culture, in music culture, that idea of going, this is my brand, you know.
Know what you're selling, but yeah, sorry, you can't.
But the poster with a mic instead of a rifle.
The Malcolm X one.
The Malcolm X one.
Yeah.
That poster was imbued with, I am, like, in terms of branding, was like, this is, I'm serious about this.
Uh-huh.
There's some imagery that I'm playing with here.
Yeah.
This is about a thing, and I'm unafraid to be about a thing.
Yeah.
Even if years from now, Goldsmith will misunderstand the point of the image.
That's all our big worries. I don't know, but, you know, again, like, that image, or having that image, because I had that image in my head for years. Like, I always wanted to post
it. I was kind of pleased to hear that, because it feels like it had a lot of attention.
Oh, man, like, I had that for years. And you know what? I regret couple things about that is I wanted to call the show By Any Means Necessary, but I let all these other people influence me. You know, you should call it something a bit, and I shouldn't have listened to them. I should have called it By Any Means.
What did you call it in the end?
Chickens Come Home to Roost.
Yeah.
But okay. I wanted to call it By Any Means, and yeah. I shouldn't have listened to anyone.
But that, I feel like that poster promised big.
Yeah.
In a way, I didn't see that show.
Yeah.
But I feel like what you're saying is you don't feel like you've kind of had the big breakout Edinburgh show. So what's that feel like being in that position where you're like, some of these bits take the roof off and are meaningful and big, but it doesn't add up, or it hasn't added up in your estimation to a solid hour of...
Yeah, I mean, like, again, it's like, so, you know, I got my own thing of my own artistic conquest. I mean, in terms of like I've always sold well. Like, luckily, like, I've had blessed years where I've sold okay. I do okay review-wise, I do fine. You know what I'm saying? It's not, like, nothing to do with that. Like, my thing isn't, oh, breakout. You say breakout, and breakouts kind of insinuates that, you know, I never had that Edinburgh, which I kind of probably didn't, but I think I've done okay business-wise.
Absolutely. You know, and I'm only saying that because I felt like that's what you said.
No. I hear what you're saying. No, but I'm saying, for me, it's deeper than that. For me, it is that thing of I never had it because I just never... And I always, like, my last shows are always wrote in a rush. Like, I never just had that, okay, boom, I'm just going to go Edinburgh and have that Edinburgh show. And I never did it because, like, the first Edinburgh, that show you saw, I mean, that post you're talking about, I was filming a TV show during that time. Mm-hmm. Like, I had flown back from another country filming to go do Edinburgh. Do you know what I'm saying, though? Like, I was just filming a show throughout that year I should have been writing. So the show wasn't that good. The other time I did an Edinburgh show, I was filming a show, so I never had time to write. You know what I'm saying? So always like, I just...
Your successful career on TV was getting in... No. What I'm about to say is your successful career on TV is getting in the way of the fringe show designed to get you a successful career on TV.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird though, because for me, do you know what? My last Edinburgh is the funnest time I've had because I did a work in progress and I actually felt like...
Same, man. God, I loved it.
I felt like I was at an art festival. For the first time, I felt like I was at an arts festival, and I felt like, damn, like, I'm actually, you know, I'm putting bits together, and I'm, you know what I mean? Like, funny enough,
I'm participating in art.
But a lot of, like, people were, like, saying, giving me shit. Like, one of my friends, she was giving me shit. She was like, you're an idiot for not making this into an Edinburgh show, because this is probably the best show you wrote. But you know what I'm saying? But I didn't care about that anymore. Like, I just, you know, like, a lot, and it's what was, like, my sort of goals and tastes of what I want have changed. Do you know what I'm saying? So, like, that sort of idea of, you know, oh, you know, Edinburgh, and they're going to bust and blow up, and it's just like, I don't know what that means to me anymore.
I've got like a working pet theory about comedians and how we're all brave once, which is, apologies to the listener if you've heard me say this in a recent episode, but just like the decision to go from I'm a regular person to I'm someone that's done some stand-up comedy is a huge decision and is accompanied often with terror and nerves and the rest of it. And it's like breaking out of a state of normalcy into the other, the unknown. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then as soon as we become comics, we just straight back down into normalcy. What do all the comics do? What am I supposed to do? How can I fit in? You know, we've just deliberately fitted out as hard as possible and then go back to trying to fit in. And I wonder, for someone like you who... It seems like your comic practice is about just being yourself and talking as you talk and enjoyment and pleasure and freedom and all, like, you know, getting rewarded financially very early on for like breaking out of the couch and going, this is naturally what I am. Where do you sit at the moment in terms of, like, do you feel like things are expected of you as a comic, or do you feel happily like you're just doing whatever the fuck you want?
Mix of both, man. A mix of both. Like, I, you do have an expectation. Do you know what I'm saying? There is an expectation of, oh, you should, you know, you know, people, like, you know, it's like, even if I go on tour, people are paying for tickets. So they expect a certain, do you know what I'm saying? There is that level of expectation, or people have seen you on a thing, and so they expect something. But I try not to, and I'm not saying it hasn't, because I'm not perfect, but I try not to let that affect my judgment. And to not let that affect what I do, because the way for me to keep on recreating the stuff that I think's good is to be sort of just in the moment with it and not think, overthink things. So you can overthink. And I feel like it's not our job to overthink it. That's the people who take 15%. It's their job to worry about shit, about how, what the brand is. And you know what I'm saying? No, I don't think that's our job. It is our job now, but at the same time, I don't think it should be. Mm. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm. No, like I don't know. I think I'm like, a little part of me thinks I'm like, I wish I was around 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Like, I think I would have enjoyed myself more.
Because
pre-internet, you could fucking, you know, you could do a line of coke and take a photo.
Hang around the same hour for 10 years.
Yeah. I want to be that guy.
And I'm saying, hang around it, that's very disrespectful. But also, you could have perfected the same hour. That you could have ended up with an hour that was wall-to-wall.
I don't mean not turning over. I don't mean that part. I mean just the idea of it not being so brand-orientated and not having to worry about that. But I try my hardest not to care about it. I do make a conscious effort to be like, I'm just doing this.
Are you writing a new stand-up show at the moment?
Yeah, I'm going on tour.
Okay, so I'm the tour is...
And I'm going to start in January.
Okay, the tour is exclusive of Edinburgh?
I might even do a run. I'm still working out, you know how it's like, okay. I'm trying to work out stuff. But I might do Edinburgh, but I'm doing some tour dates in Edinburgh, so I don't know. But anyway, so I'm doing a new show, Strip Club Einstein, which I took to America.
Good title.
I just wanted a really dumb title, because all my titles have been dumb. It's all been Vape Lord, Strip Club Einstein.
Oh, Vape Lord.
I just like dumb shit. I find something funny about doing it. But Strip Club Einstein, so I'm doing that tour now. And so that's the one I took to America. I've done a couple of days in America. I done like Tucson, Arizona, and Phoenix. Done like really weird spots. Like, just kind of wanted to do it. You know what I'm saying?
How are those places? Because I hope to wait to fun, do bro. More in America.
Fun, man. Like, I have such a good time out there. Like, I just enjoy it. I like being in America. You know what I'm saying? And do you know what? Like, there was like, I remember the first time I did America, I did two shows in New York in Brooklyn, done like solo shows for the comedy festival. And there was something about walking on stage in New York that just fucking, I don't know, man. There's something about it that just like, yo, like I couldn't, you know what I'm saying?
I thought I was a comedian. Turns out I'm a rap god.
It's
so culturally important.
Yeah, there was something about it. And it was like, you know, because for me, like when I talk about like doing comedy, it's weird because earlier you were talking about big bits for big stages. Mm. Bro, I like a nice 150 seater, man. Mm. There is, I'm not, like, because on my last tour, I was blessed to be able to do like Hackney Empire. For my London date.
Mm-hmm. How big's that? It's got to be...
That's like 1,000 or something like that.
Okay.
And I was be able to do that for my London date. And it was, you know, big and shit. And there's obviously a level of enjoyment of that. You know, I love doing that, you know, because it's like a level of like, damn, a lot of people come to see me. And you know what I'm saying? It's like a good feeling towards that, you know. And my mum got to see it and that, and it was nice, but... You know, there's something about that 150 seater, 200 seater, where it's just tight, low ceiling, like that. Like, and that was in New York, and I just felt like, and it's that type of stuff I enjoy, really. You know what I'm saying? That type of stuff fills me with more joy than most things other.
Yeah.
That, you know, that you would be surprised to, like, oh, you know what I'm saying? I'd be like, yo, that other stuff made me more happy and shit.
When I said big bits earlier on, I think the bigness that I'm referring to is the clarity of the premise.
Okay. I mean? I must have misunderstood. Like, I wasn't criticizing what you were saying. Sure. I'm saying though, like, just to link it back to this New York stuff. Yeah, I love that small room shit, man.
But you are so good at a clear premise. You're so like, I wish I had that ability to go to kind of forage in a topic until you go, what is it? It's old people can't vote. You know, or like it's that one, or it's the vagina stock market thing. Do you mean you go two things? Those moments, like I get some of them when the planets align, and you're like, oh, this is like that, chung, and you can just put those two things next to each other and refract the whole routine.
I find harder finding the first sentence of the line than I do writing the rest of the joke. Like, I find the punchline easier than writing the top line. Like, my problem is, and it's weird you say that, because I feel like my problem is explaining the premise is harder for me. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
So for me to have that top line of like, okay, this is the bit. So I think what I've done consciously or subconsciously is just made it easy. So I've gone, oh, people cannot vote. And this is why. Boom.
Yeah.
Because like, I try to make the top line of the premise a lot more intelligent than I am. That's like, I love Alfie Brown. Because Alfie Brown can give you such an intelligent top line, and it's subtle, and you know, I just, my brain can't do it. I'm not smart enough. So my shit has to be basic. My shit has to be, this bit is about this. And then yes. and then I can work nuances in the routine.
Yes.
I find like punchlines, I write punchlines a lot easier than I do top lines. Like, this is the clearness of the bit. Okay, boom, boom, boom.
That's interesting, because I don't see that as a failing at all. If you look at that bit, the ting ting eggs.
It's not failing. It's not failing. It's just who I am. It's
sure,
not,
sure, sure.
You know,
it's
not that, funny, but
that ting ting bit from way back.
Yeah.
Like, that is what, and it's like we talk about one thing, and then it's revealed that what we've been talking about this whole time is communism / the economy, all the rest of it. And so for me, that, like, the feeling for me as a viewer, whether that's an illusion or not, is that, like, the setup you always knew. Mm. To me, it looks like he's like, okay, Jamali's going to talk some stuff about the economy now, but first he's going to lead us up the garden path with some goofball bit about eggs.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, but actually it was all about this.
So
which way round does it work for you? Is it that you're finding something deep in something mundane, or is it that you have something deep and you need to find a way
into
it?
No, I have the mundane thing and I find the deepness in it. Do you know what I'm saying, though?
Yeah.
Like,
that's such a skill, man.
Like, for me, like, that bit about Ting Ting and the eggs, that bit started as just a bit about this real roommate I had who ate my egg. Do you know what I'm saying? And then later I was like, because she's communist. And then, boom, boom.
Yes, does that make sense? Yes. Yeah,
it's like, all those premises start with me just finding a basic thing.
Mm-hmm.
And wanting to talk about a basic thing, mm-hmm. and then it just happens to end up into a bit about this. Does that make sense, though?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And what does it look like, that process of you writing it? Are you writing on your phone, on a laptop?
If I'm on a train and I think to myself, man, I want to write a bit about train doors, right? I'll put "train doors are ridiculous" in my phone, and there'll be a note that I can't read later. And then what I'll do is I'll then take it and I write it all down on a notepad. And I've got severe dyslexia, so I can't really read my own handwriting a lot of the time. But for whatever reason, I still write it down by hand. And I write it all down, and I write the beginning, the middle, and the end of the bit. So I have the beginning bit, the middle of the bit, the end, and I write the whole bit down verbatim. And then I take it onto stage, and I never say anything I wrote down. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and
totally.
I don't know why I've spent half a day writing this shit down. Because what I do is, when I write bits on stage, really, because what I do is I'll take the premise on stage, and sometimes I'll mix it with crowd work to try and find the honesty.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Because I try and have crowd work. Because I feel like when I'm just riffing or something, I'm speaking more honestly. So I'll riff it with someone. So I'll throw it to this guy and I'll be like, what do you think about this? Boom, boom, boom. And I'm kind of having a conversation, but in a humorous way, to then work it out. And then what I've done is I take that little bit that I've had from that I wrote down of like just a line or something. So the reason I realized I've been writing it is because I had like a line in it, or there was an ending to it, or do you know what I'm saying? So in that moment, I'm kind of thinking about it, and I'm kind of thinking back to what I was writing, and then I use that line that kind of ends it, or do you know what I'm saying? No, but yeah. it's mostly writing.
Yeah,
stage.
It's a kind of it's leveraging the crisis of actually speaking to a human actually in front of an audience.
Yes, 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 yes.
To leap from one thing to another.
And I speak to myself. I talk to myself a lot. I realize I have big conversations. Like, what I do is I walk down the street and I'll talk to myself. And in my mind, it sounds fucking insanity, but in my mind, I visualize that I'm performing.
Uh-huh.
So in my mind, I'm daydreaming as I'm walking, visualizing I'm on stage. And as I'm visualizing I'm on stage, I'm talking to myself and I'm going through the bits myself, but walking down the street, Oxford Circus, looking like a psychopath.
Yeah.
But I'm talking to myself. Like, I talk to myself, like I mumble to myself. I walk around mumbling because I'm in my mind, I'm imagining. I'm going to get sectioned. And I'm talking to myself, imagining I'm performing.
Yeah.
And that's how I sort of work bits out, or do you know what I'm saying? Right?
Yeah.
Sometimes I imagine I'm riffing with someone.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll have crowd work with someone who isn't there. It's myself.
I do that with arguments.
You do that with arguments? Yeah.
Arguments that never took place.
Yeah.
I imagine.
Yeah.
that cyclist nearly ran into me. He didn't, but if he did, I'd say that, and he'd probably say that. And I'd win, and actually none of it took place.
You have the imaginary fight where you go, I'll do the uppercut. He'll probably sit back a little bit. But you know what I mean? I'm quick with the legs. But yeah, we're fucking cycles. But yeah, that's what I do. Or sometimes I'll have a bit in my mind, and I can feel it kind of working in the back of my head, but I'm not thinking about it, but it's kind of working in the back, and then it will, like a little bit later, my brain will go, hey, what do you think about this?
And what have you cut from the tour show, in the writing of the tour show? What have you had to let go of? Like, either stuff you couldn't make work, or stuff you think's like not bit, me there, now?
Yeah, you know, there's like a lot of bits that, you know, just don't work anymore, or I've done them too much, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, because I, you know, because I previewed this show last Edinburgh, and I've sort of been working on it. So, you know, there's stuff that just ain't really irrelevant anymore. There's stuff that I just don't believe in as much. Because I think you can do a killer routine enough where it's just, you know, it dies behind the eyes and you just got to fucking do
it. It's weird, isn't it? I mean, I feel the same. I think that is a very British thing, though. I think in this stuff. These days, the sorts of comics that we've heard of in the States turn over loads and loads. But obviously, there's a culture for years of like, you know, get your dynamite hour and do the college circuit for 10 years. And I think there is, you know, there is something to be said for honing something until it's just bomb-proof.
The thing is, they were allowed to have that dynamite bomb-proof hour because it was financially gratifying to have a bulletproof hour.
Mm-hmm.
Where here, it's more career and financially gratifying to turn over an hour every year.
Mm-hmm.
And turn over an hour every year, I think it builds a different skill.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it necessarily builds the same skill. Like, you know, I think that's why if you look at the top percentile of the best comedians are Americans, because, you know, they work the clubs. And I'd done a club in America. Like, I did the Punchline.
San Francisco.
I did the weekend. So we do the five. You do the Thursday, Friday, mm-hmm. Saturday, two shows, boom, boom, boom. Some of them ain't your crowd, you know, because a lot of time I was doing like little rooms like a rock club or a Tuesday at a comedy club.
Yeah.
It's just people who know what I do.
Yeah.
And actually doing that weekend and you've got to do an hour. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. it's not an arts festival. It's not like Edinburgh, where it's an arts festival where people are like, oh, I'm willing to just listen to you for 10 minutes mm-hmm. and see where you're going. No, it's a comedy club. It's Friday night. They've had a shit day at work. I want, you know what I'm saying? I want to get.
And you've got to do an hour. And I'm you've got to close out a show while they drop checks.
Bro, and I'm eating chicken wings. They're dropping checks. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, and you realize, oh yeah, that's why their hours are just fucking rocking. Because they just, they have to be put through a different pace where we don't really do the hour stuff here. We, you know, we do the 20 minute stuff and then the Edinburgh stuff. And, you know, so it is a different skill set. And I think that's why probably why they have their top percentile of some of the best dudes are from over there.
We skated over it at the time, but you talked about nearly dying.
Yeah. I was doing shows in Bangkok. I'd done a show in Indonesia and I felt real ill. And I did a show in Bangkok and I ended up going blind and fainting and that. And I was like, I was in my bed and I could feel like my heart being grabbed. Like it felt like I was having a heart attack. And I had gone to doctors earlier that day and they said I had the flu. And I just, my heart was just, and I remember, and I booked a different hotel to what the guy booked me, because he mm-hmm. booked me some shit hotel. So I booked a different hotel, because it's Thailand, so it was cheap to book a nicer one. And I booked a different hotel, and I remember I had to text people to let them know where I was, because, you know, I don't want to die. You know? And I remember this, like, and I remember being 27 and being like, I don't want to die iconically. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, I don't want to be in the 27 club. I don't want to die like that. And I remember feeling like, fuck, I'm out. Like, and it's that weird feeling of going to sleep and not being able to wake up and not waking yourself up. And I remember I woke up and I was sweating, just buckets of sweat. And I had to go back to the hospital and they said I had measles and my lungs had hemorrhaged.
Jesus.
So I was like coughing up blood and that, and I was in the ICU for like
on the other side of the world.
Yeah, for a week and a half I was in the ICU and that, and yeah, and I, but again, it's like, you know, it's like doing that dumb shit. I remember I left the hospital ICU for a week. My eyes went blind because I had my corneas cracked while dehydrated.
Jesus Christ!
And I took a week off, then went straight to Australia to the gig. You know what I'm saying? So it's like it's just doing shit like that. You know what I'm saying? And you go, man, like you know, you got to really, you know, think of the worth. But it's like I just like comedy, man. You know what I'm saying? Like I was willing to fucking, you know, I just like, I miss it, like, you know what I'm saying? I didn't want to be off. I wanted to be in Australia experiencing that, being in Melbourne. And you know what I'm saying?
So, how'd you find it?
Well, I mean, I was fucking half dead, so I didn't really feel good. I like Sydney though.
Yeah,
I really like Sydney, man. The thing about Sydney is kind of those, like, they're more working people, They just want to have a laugh. They ain't got time for none of this bullshit. Like, I like Sydney, man. Like, I have a good time in Sydney, yeah.
I found Melbourne, the comedy festival in Melbourne, for someone who's been to Edinburgh so many times over the years, to just go, new stuff!
People I've
never heard of. Whole scenes going back 20 years that I've never heard of, and I've no idea. Scene.
I like being Australian, though. I mean, it's just fucking far, isn't it? That's the problem. It's too far.
Yeah.
It is too far.
Same problem with Edinburgh. If Edinburgh was where Birmingham is, I'd live
there. Oh, mate, 100%. Yeah. But it's too far. But I'm not having a good time. I'm going back as well. I'm going back to Australia. And I'm doing two nights in Melbourne. And I'm doing like a week in Sydney. Do you know where I have a really good time? In New Zealand. It's weird because New Zealand...
Just for the benefit of the listener, I'm smiling beatifically.
Yeah, I like it. New Zealand shows are rocking, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember like they like a show in New Zealand that didn't do good anywhere else.
Okay.
Like I did this show for Vice, and it was like during the mid-season, I was contracted to do another show. So I did a show where it was me, Alfie Brown, Sean McLaughlin and Fern Brady went around Europe.
That's a bill.
And it was called Brexit Stage Left, and it was a mess, and the show didn't fucking really do well. But they loved it in New Zealand.
Yeah, right.
It was like a weird, like the only place I liked it was New Zealand. So I had people coming up to me after the show saying like, yo, we love Brexit Stage Left. What the fuck are you on about? We love Sean. Is that fucking weird, man? But yeah, so I like New Zealand. But yeah, I like, you know, that's one of my favorites is I like to travel, man. So I like to be over there in a different part of the world trying to make people laugh. I think that's kind of something cool about that.
We know we talked a little bit about your... not being ambitious in the sense that some comics are ambitious. I mean, I'm sure you've got your drives. You're always going to succeed. What does success look like? Where would you like to be 10, 20 years from now? Do you have any?
Honestly, like, I like to, like, and the thing is like this. It's like, you know, I don't want to create a false image of myself to people out there, especially other comics that know me. They'll be like, man, that's bullshit. I want to make some money. Like, I ain't fucking, you know, I want to make some money and shit. You know what I mean? I like buying nice trainers. I want to have a, you know, live in a decent house and that. But if I could honestly do what I want to do creatively, like, I'd be happy with that. You know what I'm saying? If I could just genuinely do what I want to do and, you know, if I can do a tour to like 200 seats, you know, do some shows in America now and again, do some Australia, you know, do a little project or, you know, maybe write a cartoon. I'm like, you know, like I'm real cool with that. Like I don't need to be the richest man in the world. You know what I'm saying? And not to say I don't want any money. I want to be comfortable. You know what I'm saying? I want to be able to, you know, help my family and do shit like that. And I don't want to starve. You know what I mean? I want to give my kids a nice life and shit. Afford them things I couldn't have. But at the same time, like, you know, like if I could just be free, that's what I see success as, is freedom to really just your creative vision and just to, you know, be able to produce what is honest to you. And I think that's kind of success for me, you know. But where do I see myself in 10, 15 years is one of the questions, was it? I don't know. Like, I really don't know. I kind of don't want to know. Like, I'm happy just riding it out and seeing where it goes. Like, I don't really need to know. I don't. If someone bursts into more and say, no, listen, Angel Comedy Club, we've got a time machine. Let's go 10 years. You want to have a peep? Like, I'm good, man. Fuck it. You know what I'm saying? I'm good. I'm good just to see where it goes.
So that was Jamali. Great fun talking to him. Really, really vigorous act and someone who has done so much in such a short time that I can't wait to see what he does next. That's JamaliMaddox.com to find out about his new live work and his tour coming up. And also at Jamali Maddox on Twitter, obviously, probably Instagram as well. So that's that. Thanks to everyone for helping recording and uploading this episode. The editor was Nathan Wood. We recorded at Angel Comedy, angelcomedy.co.uk, to find out more about the brilliant work that they're doing. The music was by Rob Smouten. Podcast consultant is Peter Dobbing, and the logging was JK Crossland. That is it for now. You had a whole Conan debrief post-amble previously, so if you're in need of a post-amble now, feel free to flick back an episode on the feed and listen to that one. I'm not going to post-amble at you now simply because I'm on holiday, and I should have pre-recorded this much earlier than I did, because now my children are in a sandpit and my wife is playing with them on her own, which will not stand. I wish to be in the sandpit, so I'm going to go and do that now. There is another episode zinging its way towards you next week, because I've got loads of stuff in the can.
And also, if you're on the Comedians Comedian Podcast Facebook group, have a little butchers at that, because we've got some polls this week. I'm trying to refresh the stuff that I send out to new joiners up of the Insiders Club and new people that join the mailing list, which kind of directs them to the top 10 episodes in various different categories. So if you're in the Facebook group, you can join in and vote on those right now. And finally, remember, there are 33 minutes of extra material from this episode with Jamali available exclusively to members of the Insiders Club, comedianscomedian.com/insiders. That will do for now. Go about your business. I hope you're having a lovely January. I am in that slightly kind of, I need to get moving and get on and do stuff, but I'm on holiday, so I'm having power hours here and there. And this concludes one of them. Bye for now. Speak to you next week.